Okay, you guys ready to record?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, something's wrong. Guys, I just checked online, and it says there hasn't been a podcast called Let's Learn Everything in over 50 years!
Whoa!
Goodness.
Spooky. What has so spooky?
What happened to time? Oh.
Oh my god. Are we all dead? Are we ghosts?
Yeah, so okay, hold on. Like, what's the logic here? Are you who's the ghost? Is the podcast the ghost? Is
yeah, exactly. I don't understand the joke.
Or maybe it's the listeners.
Oh,
look,
no.
Look behind you! What's that behind you? It's one of us! Woo! All right, okay, cool.
Hello and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting or spooky. This episode, as always, we'll be covering a main science / spooky topic, answering a question, and then covering
slash
a good old
spooky question.
Spooky question.
How many times can I put the word spooky into this?
And today's question is trick or treat.
My name is Caroline. I'm doing our main topic this episode, which is going to be less spooky, but we're linking it ever so slightly. It's going to be the science of pain in animals.
Ooh.
That is spooky.
It's Halloween-y. It feels appropriate. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My name's Tom, and you already know what my question is.
Trick or treat?
No. Say it.
Are you a vampire?
I'm impossibly fast and strong. My skin is pale white and ice cold. My eyes change color. Say it out loud.
Vampire.
Today's question is, how much of vampirism is true in actual vampiric animals?
Wow.
What a great question. Fun. I can't believe I got that immediately.
You did?
I was like, I know that's a Twilight quote. You already know.
Gosh.
I'm mad at myself for not getting it, to be honest.
My name is Ella, and today's miscellaneous topic is penny dreadfuls.
Do I know what that is?
You might not know what that is, and that's exciting to me.
I've heard the word so many times, but I don't think I could tell you
I'm
like an actual
scared.
Like...
Should I be scared or should I not be scared? I'm
You'll find out. But the scariest thing of all is that we are now part of the Maximum Fun Network.
Ooh.
In fact, it's not scary at all. It's amazing. It's a wonderful thing. And you can support Maximum Fun and us by going to MaximumFun.org/join and becoming a member.
And speaking of vampire content, our Twilight Watch Along will eventually be up very soon in the Maximum Fun bonus content feed. So if you want to get that horrible joke I just made, you can watch that and be up to date on Twilight.
We are talking today about the science of pain, specifically the pain in animals, although we will be talking about human pain quite a lot as well today. If anybody doesn't want to hear that, that's valid. You can skip on over to the next topic.
Wait, so we're going to be animal focused, not human focused.
We are going to be. So it's going to be a bit of a mix of stuff. I'm talking about like humans a lot to give us context for some of the stuff we're talking about afterwards. But yeah, this is going to be looking at animals for the most part.
Interesting. I feel like this is one I'm going to have to ask a lot of questions about because it is
good.
So intuitive. It's just like, oh, it's pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's what that is.
And I feel like there are a lot of assumptions made about animal pain because like for a lot of animals, it's almost exactly the same for how we process pain. But for a lot of animals, there are some people who think that some animals don't feel pain at all or don't feel pain in the same way that we do. There's a lot of unknowns when it comes to animal pain, whereas we know quite a lot about human pain at this point. We've done a lot of research on it. So, yeah, we're going to talk about human pain and then use that as sort of the building blocks for figuring out what's going on the animal side of things.
Okay.
So, obviously, pain is not a pleasant thing for any living being to go through. But acute pain, which is...
For some.
Well, we don't kink shame here, but...
I was just going to say, it is so funny with topics like these to be like, it sounds like Merriam-Webster defines pain as not good and we don't like it, but we do have to establish.
Yeah, it feels like a good place to start this of like, pain bad, don't want pain for the most part. We're talking specifically about acute pain for this episode, so chronic pain is something slightly different. I'll mention that in a second. But also, pain is a mechanism that is really, really useful for us. It can help us understand when our body is damaged. It can help us prevent further damage to our bodies, and also kind of potentially like force our bodies into like resting to heal from any damage that we've received. So pain is a super useful thing. So it makes sense that a lot of animals would experience pain as well, obviously.
Yeah,
it is so... Yeah, that is a good point, because on the one hand, it does feel deeply human and personal because we all experience it. But on the other hand, it totally makes sense as being like a base evolutionary thing, right?
Yeah,
like one
absolutely.
Of the first things.
Yeah, it's understanding when your body is damaged. Yeah.
Yeah, there are people with disorders where they don't feel pain correctly. Mm-hmm. And they're really dangerous. You can push yourself, your body, to limits that it shouldn't be going to because you're not feeling pain. It's like it's such a base sense.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's the phrase. Yeah.
So again, I'm talking mostly about acute pain today. Chronic pain is sometimes caused by the same sort of mechanisms that we're going to talk about today. Sometimes it's not. So if you're a chronic pain sufferer, just be aware that a lot of the science we talk about today might not apply to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start this topic off with a little question. Do you think every animal can feel pain?
Holy moly.
What a question, right? I just want to hear your thoughts. And if you... like, any thoughts about specific animals or
holy
anything like
moly.
That? Yeah, I know.
No.
Okay.
I just think, I feel like, I changed my answer. Yes.
You think yes? Okay.
I'm thinking most mammals, birds.
Yeah.
Maybe even fish. I know there's also been some articles I've read that it's like gets into the philosophy of whether certain animals can feel pain. But
yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, it feels like it's a very base thing.
What pain is not the question you're asking, though, right? Like what pain feels like, you know?
Right, right.
I cannot imagine that pain feels the same to all animals. And
of
the
course,
thing about pain in humans
great point.
That we associate it with like distress. And a lot of animals just don't have the capacity to feel that feeling.
You have nailed every single thing that I'm going to talk about for the first like half of
Ella.
This. That is like absolutely on it. So there are a lot of animals that like obviously respond to their bodies being damaged. But does that constitute as pain as we know it? Do they feel pain in a different way?
Hmm.
Do they feel pain at all? And they're just making sure that their bodies don't get damaged any further. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, like, is it just like a feeling of, oh, my limb is missing now? It doesn't...
Yeah.
I'm not hurt. I'm just aware that it is because of the receptors there or whatever.
Well, we know if they can derive... a kink pleasure from it, then they do feel pain. So that's one barometer we have. If we ever see like an armadillo hitting another armadillo and they're smiling, we're like, okay, they can feel pain.
Yeah. Before we continue on, I want to define what pain is. And obviously it's really, really hard to talk about animals, so I'm going to talk about humans for a lot of this part. So... do either of you
It's just being like, all right, it's time for me to define pain for you guys. It's like, ow, Caroline! Wow.
I was waiting for you to make a joke, Tom, but I thought the joke was going to go more in the direction of, oh, pain is when you listen to My Chemical Romance and after your girlfriend has dumped you. I was like, is he going to do it? I could see your eyes twinkling. I was like, where's he going with this?
That was a much better... No, go for it. Next time you steal that glory.
It's not my cup of tea. I just
pain
have to wait.
Pain is a forlorn look in a cafe.
Yeah, exactly. I was like waiting for
pain
that.
Pain is love through a one-way mirror.
Oh, my goodness.
Ew, no, that's creepy.
Wow. Yeah, no, we don't want that, Tom.
So dumb.
Oh, God.
Okay, so... Can either of you think of a definition for pain?
No, honestly, no.
Yeah.
It feels, I know maybe to some people it won't, but to me it feels very much like the question, what is art?
Yeah.
Wow, huh?
It's just like
quite a comparison.
It's personal. And yeah, for humans, yeah, it's personal what pain is.
That is a great point.
And when we did the miscellaneous topic where Tom talked about animal art, and we thought about that question, what is art? Between animals and human, what is art is different. And between animals and humans, what is pain is different.
That's a great point. Wow. Oh, that is actually a surprisingly good metaphor. I'm surprised. If I had to define pain, it would be the psychological feeling of distress caused by an outside force of some kind. I don't know.
Caroline, you think, is that right?
So,
I'm so curious. Yeah.
The International Association for the Study of Pain describes pain as
institution.
Yeah, the International Association for the Study of Pain describes pain as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage.
The and
potential. That, can you read that one more time? That was beautiful.
Yeah, totally. So it's an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated
and
with
emotional
actual or potential tissue damage, or described in terms of such damage.
Okay. The and emotional is like so distinct there. That changes my, I honestly think if we are saying that that is what pain is, then that would change my answer to, do animals, all animals feel pain, would be no, because I don't think that there's evidence that a lot of animals have emotional responses to pain or to like harm.
And can I ask, I apologize, or maybe you're going to say, but like, is this definition specifically for humans? Is that what, where this...
Yeah. I was just going to say this. So this definition is obviously mostly associated with humans, but when we look at the research done on like establishing if animals can feel pain, this is a definition that crops up all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So we do use this definition a lot for all sorts of things. Yeah. So I think we're going off on a small little tangent now, because the thing I think that surprised me the most about this one was the inclusion of the little thing, or potential tissue damage.
Yeah.
There you
I
go.
Love that. That's really interesting.
That's just the, is that not just the psychological aspect of it? Because like, people feel pain without having actual, like, without physical damage. So I assume it's just like, you know, perceived pain.
It is. Would you guys like a really funny example of this happening?
Oh, yes,
I
please.
I have one written down.
Funny, so, a funny example
well,
of pain.
Funny is as a strong word, but like shocking, maybe almost.
I love this. I love the idea that like, we could, at any point, we could have been like, Caroline, can you come up with a funnier example for this, please? Because the answer is always yes. We want the funnier example. I'm so curious, please.
So, in 1995, Fisher et al. Reported of a case where a construction worker accidentally jumped on a 7-inch long nail. It pierced through his boot and through his foot. I take it neither of you have heard of this before, because it is really, really famous.
No!
I think I might have heard of it, but I can't. I'm really like getting shivers right now.
It's awful, isn't it? Yeah. So the story goes that
You are right, Caroline. It's so funny so far.
So funny, right? Shocking was definitely the word I should have used for that one. The story goes that they took him to hospital. He is in absolute agony all the way there because he has nailed
through his
foot.
This one. It didn't.
No way.
I know. Sorry, you finish.
He has to
and
have
he's Pagliacci. Sorry, continue.
He has to have intravenous sedation in the emergency room to deal with his foot. They cut his boot off, and his foot is completely unharmed. The nail went in between his toes.
That's amazing!
Yeah. But the feeling of pain was completely real to him, because obviously
That's
his brain
so
is seeing
cool.
his foot. he's taking in all of these like sensory cues around him. His colleagues are all in like complete shock at what's happened. So his brain has interpreted that as him being in pain and there's damage being caused to his
foot. That is funny now because he didn't
it's
hurt
funny
himself.
Yeah.
Also, this is another example I would use is like, but it's like phantom limb pain for people like amputees.
Yeah, I was just gonna say,
Is it kind of similar process? Mm-hmm.
There is another example of this at like the other end of the spectrum where a guy accidentally shot a nail into his skull but didn't realize that this had happened, so he went to the hospital complaining about toothache and they actually found a huge nail like in his like physically through his skull. So that's a rough one.
That is so interesting. And it also, like, as bonkers as it is, part of me wonders, like, how much of that is a very human thing that can happen, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder if imagined pain exists as much in other animals, or it's because we are emotional
Question, yeah.
The main takeaway from that is just have blistering confidence in workplace injuries. You'll be better, I guess. This is fine.
There is something to be said for pain relief through not acknowledging pain. This is not to say that people who suffer chronic pain or anything like that should just like ignore it or anything.
Well,
this
is actually something that I've talked about a little bit through my job, which is people who do suffer chronic pain, especially through like one limb. There's something called a mirror box where you put your like normal limb through like outside the box and your painful limb through this other box, but there's a mirror in between you and your two limbs and you can only see your limb that's not in pain moving. And just seeing that your pain, like your limb isn't in pain, even though it actually still is, can help reduce your symptoms. So again, it's the idea of like,
you can also scratch yourself like that, by the way. If you have eczema on like one arm and you're not allowed to scratch it, you can use a mirror to scratch the good arm and it will look like you're scratching the bad arm and it will relieve the itching.
Yeah, and this is also another one that's used to treat phantom limb pain, which is something we've talked about a lot already as well. So stuff like that can be used for chronic pain. Obviously, we're not talking too much about it today, but it is, like, if you want to learn more about it, it's so, so interesting to see how we do treat chronic pain without using painkillers in this sort of way. So that's really, really interesting.
I do think, to Ella's point, that you can't, there are many things you can't think your way out of.
That's not to downplay the fact that there are like psychological tools you can use to relieve pain if you need
definitely. Your pain is valid, I think, is what we all want to say at the end of
that. Of course it is.
Nuance, baby.
Nuance. That's the next comedy.
That's the next
word.
Nuance, baby.
If you would like a little bit more detail about the nail through the foot guy or the nail through the skull guy, there is a 2007 paper. If you scroll down to figure 1, there are some fantastic images of that sort of stuff. So you can go and see that there.
Spooky. Also a great couple's Halloween costume.
Oh my God, Tom. No.
I'm going as Phineas Gage to a Halloween party this year.
Are
you actually?
No. No.
That would be great. I would love that.
I'm down for that. That's actually a really good costume.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the emotional side of pain, but how much do you guys know about the more like the actual mechanisms for pain in our bodies? Do you know much about it?
I mean, nerves.
Or do you want to take it? Yeah, nerves is a great place to start.
I feel like I should know more about this given my background in biomedical science.
I was going to rely on you, Ella.
But for some reason, this is like a real blank. The only thing I can think of is like heat receptors, like capsaicin receptors, and how they can trigger like a pain response.
Yeah.
But that is still differential, I know, from other kinds of pain. I assume there's some kind of area in the brain specifically that lights up when you're in pain.
Yeah. So I'm not going to talk
about the one fact I know about pain reception in the body is that it some pain reactions don't even go to the brain.
Yes. Yeah.
Are you going to talk about this, Caroline?
I am, but you can talk about it first. Go for it.
Oh, thank you. I was just going to say, this is one of my favorite things about in terms of like how cognition works, that there are some pain reactions that have to happen so quickly that they don't even go to the brain. They just go straight to the spinal cord to make that motor reaction reflex, like when you like touch something hot and pull away.
Oh, that's the same as like a reflex, like you know, when doctors back tap on your knee, and you that's the same. Yeah. That's the same.
We're definitely going to talk about reflexes in a second. You guys are so on it this week. Oh my goodness!
This is how I felt. This is how I felt last week.
Yeah, this is so good. So I'm going to do a slightly more fleshed out version of this in a second. But I think the most basic understanding is that damage happens on our body, which triggers nerves in our skin to send signals to our brain to tell us we're in pain. Is what I think most people sort of understand about the mechanisms of pain responses. I want to talk a little bit about the person who sort of originated this idea, which is a man called René Descartes. He is a French scientist and philosopher who actually did a lot of work looking at reflexes, which is what you guys have just mentioned.
He's also the I think, therefore I am guy, right? I believe so.
I think he is. Yeah.
Big hits.
For anybody who doesn't know what a reflex is, I had just written down a rough example. You touch something, it goes ouch, you move it away. It's an unplanned or involuntary action or sequence of actions that occur after coming into contact with a stimulus, such as like burning your hand on something. Your reflex would be to pull it away and say ouch. So this is what Descartes was looking at, specifically reflex responses to pain. So he came up with a pretty famous theory, which I'm going to share now because it's great. So he believed that hollow tubes or threads were all over our body and they send messages from our brain to our skin or from our skin to our brain. So like 1600s had basically come up with a very basic idea of what a nerve is.
That's incredible. Wow. Very impressive,
absolutely wild, right? Continuing on, he believed that pain is in the form of particles and that these pain particles touch the skin.
Oh, interesting.
Triggering these tubes or strings. This is where it gets really wild.
Okay.
These strings.
I'm waiting for
then
animal spirits or something.
Tom, you nailed it.
What? Is it?
Animal spirits. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, he's the animal spirits guy. Okay, sorry.
So he believed that pain particle touches your skin, it triggers these like tubes or strings to open a valve in your brain, which then releases animal spirits into the part of your body that hurt, and those animal spirits move your limb for you.
Oh my god, it started so well.
It was so good, wasn't it? And then it just went in such a wild direction.
Well, you know.
Oh, boy.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
So I would like to point out that Descartes is not the only person who thought that spirits were moving around our body. There's a really famous one from, it's William Harvey's 1628 model for circulation, which suggests that spirits move in our body via valves so that they don't accidentally flow backwards. So, like, again, really close with the whole valve thing. That was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
But it had to go down the spirit route rather than anything else.
I don't know. Have we disproven that there aren't animal spirits running through us? I don't think so. The burden of proof.
And therefore, I can't say that it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. No.
The burden of proof is on.
Oh, my goodness. What we now know is that our bodies are actually covered in specialised nerves called nociceptors, which were discovered in 1905.
Oh, wow.
These nociceptors are all over our body, as well as on some of our internal organs, and they are specialised to detect damage either on our skin or on those organs.
That's so
interesting. So things like broken skin cells and potential damage. Nociceptors are picking up on that. Mm-hmm.
Just from like a mechanical perspective, that's fascinating. Like I'm thinking of like designing a robot that could detect something like that. That's wild.
Yeah. So nociceptors then send signals as any other nerve would, and they send them to our spinal cord. They don't all go to our brain. And this doesn't always activate a pain response. Painful stimuli actually have to pass a pain threshold, which then triggers our brain to respond appropriately.
Yeah. This is like triggering some like first year university memories right now.
So yeah, so that is a very sort of a bit more in depth, but still very brief overview of what the pain mechanism is in our bodies, specifically again for acute pain. So now that we know how pain is sort of triggered in humans, we can possibly start applying that to animals and looking for these nociceptors in other animals as well, right? That makes sense as a way of like figuring out who can feel pain and who can't.
Yes.
Totally. And again, because it comes from there's a lot of like spine reactions, loose understanding of, evolutionary development is the idea that like that is a more primitive area of the body.
So along that line, that what you're saying is that vertebrates can only experience pain in this way.
That's very
really
interesting
that you would say that. Yeah. So these receptors have been found in, like, most mammals have nociceptors.
This makes sense.
They use nociception is the word for how we experience pain.
That's a great word.
It's so good, isn't it? So nociception also occurs in bony fish, like rainbow trout. We have found nociceptors in them. Mm-hmm. So the fish debate appears to be debunked immediately because we know nociceptors exist in these fish.
Interesting.
Sea slugs also have been found to have nociceptors.
But sea slugs are invertebrates.
Sea slugs are invertebrates.
That's
so they have the same initial mechanism, but it's then different from that point onwards.
So to what you said, Tom, this is evolutionarily very, very far back, before there was even a split between vertebrates and invertebrates.
Yeah.
Totally. Wow.
Which makes sense as a survival mechanism.
Yeah, totally. We have also found nociception to occur in things like fruit flies, which I'll talk about in a minute, that was wild to me when I read that paper, was just like, in fruit flies of all things? What? But basically what I'm saying is, even in animals that don't have a spinal cord, these pain receptors, these nociceptors are very, very, like, that initial part of the mechanism is very, very similar to what we have. This thing has been, like, around for a really, really long time. So obviously all of these animals have nociceptors. So does that answer the question of can animals feel pain? It doesn't feel like it does, does it? Yeah.
It's interesting, Caroline, because we've taken this journey where it's like pain. This is how pain works in humans. Mm-hmm. Nociceptors, nociception, therefore. Yeah. But so we've taken these steps, but somewhere in there, I feel like we've lost something.
We've lost it. Well, we talked so much about the emotional and behavioral side of it at the beginning, didn't we? And all of a sudden it's like, where's that part of it gone?
Right, because the emotion doesn't happen on the nociceptors.
No, exactly, yeah.
Right, and the reaction doesn't happen there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so obviously there's that lack of emotional side of it, which is really, really difficult to test if an animal is having an emotional reaction to a negative stimuli. There's also that thing about like the lack of a spinal cord. Does that impact how animals are experiencing pain? Simpler nervous systems in general. Does that impact how it happens? Also, like, how much can these animals really experience pain in the same way that we can? So the next thing I want to talk about is through the world of animal pain research and looking at actual testing that we have done on animals to see if they do experience pain. Because some of these are super, super interesting and they also have some issues with them as well. So I want to talk about all of those things. So if you guys were scientists looking to see if animals experienced pain, where do you think you would start with that? What do you think you guys would do? Right?
Yeah.
It feels fundamentally unethical in some aspects.
Right? Yeah, it really does, doesn't it?
You have to cause the pain.
So, as I mentioned earlier, fruit flies are known to have these pain receptors. But one study shows that damage could lead to prolonged changes in fruit fly behavior. Okay. So possibly having some sort of behavioral or maybe not emotional, but long-term changes in how they behave after an instance where damage was caused to their bodies. So researchers damaged one leg on each individual fly in a group of fruit flies, an injury which caused long-term nerve pain in these fruit flies. After the insects were allowed to heal from this damage, researchers then placed them in a hot room to see if the flies were more responsive to stimuli. And after that leg was injured, flies would try to leave the room at lower temperatures, meaning that they were unable to withstand high temperatures in a way that undamaged fruit flies would have been.
Okay.
This is the idea that damage can occur to a fruit fly. It can heal pretty much from it, but its behavior is still changing long term, meaning that it can't withstand higher heats, basically. Does that make sense?
It
does. This is the idea of heat.
But I don't see how this like says anything about are they like experiencing pain? I don't know. Yeah. It just doesn't feel like.
Uh-huh. I think it's an interesting design, and it's definitely more clever than anything I could come up with. But I agree with Ella that like, and maybe we won't ever hit a study that ever is like decidedly is like, oh, there's pain. We found it.
As long as we are defining like pain in an emotional way, then we're just I honestly believe we can never know if animals that don't emote like humans do feel pain.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah.
I think it's interesting. Yeah. It has made me think about insect pain more than I ever have in my life.
Thinking
about that experiment.
And like, I completely agree with both of your criticisms of like, this is great. And obviously it's fantastic that like showing behavioral differences is really, really cool in fruit flies. But does that constitute an emotional response to that damage? And I'm not entirely sure that it does. That's just me personally. This is still up for debate. There are a lot of people who believe that because insects potentially don't have a consciousness, they also can't feel pain. Linking back to episode 11, where we spoke to Steve Rathjay. So if you want to learn a little bit more about insect consciousness, go and check that out. But yeah, so that's the fruit fly study that I mentioned earlier. Would you like to hear a little bit about what they did to rainbow trout? And
no,
how they
honestly,
tried to...
I don't think I do want to know. But this is the Halloween episode, so I deserve to know.
Buckle up. Spook me.
So Dr. Lynn Sneddon, who is a professor of animal biology at the University of Liverpool, decided to split captive rainbow trout into four different groups. One group was injected in the snout, which is an area that has a lot of those nociceptors, with bee venom. Another one with acetic acid, two chemicals that are actually regularly used in animal testing to bring about a pain response.
Oh, interesting.
The third group was injected with saline as a sort of control group to see if the needle poke itself was a source of any form of reaction. And then the fourth group was handled by researchers, but not injected with anything.
And kissed gently on the snout.
And again, I understand how this is valuable science, and I'm very excited to hear the results. But also, you gotta wonder, these guys, as they're injecting bee venom into a trout, being like, guys, are we the Saw people? Are we Jigsaw right now?
This is like, it's really hard, because I'm a proponent for animal research when it's well controlled and stuff, and I see the value in this. But anytime people talk about research to do with stress or pain in animals, like, it really makes it feel horrible.
It's really icky,
isn't it? We're trying to determine if these animals feel pain like humans
can
do.
And what if you find out
at the end, they're really distressed time. And then you're like, oh, okay, well, I wish I hadn't done that.
So the fourth group was not injected, just to rule out if the stress of the experiment was causing any sort of reaction. That was the final control group. Sneddon said about the research that anomalous behaviours were exhibited by the trout subject to bee venom and acetic acid. Fish demonstrated a rocking motion, strikingly similar to the kind of motion seen in stressed higher vertebrates like mammals. And the trout injected with acetic acid were also observed rubbing their lips on the gravel in the tank and the walls. These do not appear to be reflex responses. So these weren't like, oh, ouch. These were like very deliberate responses to a negative stimuli.
Okay, that is quite interesting.
Yeah, thoughts about
that one? Yeah, the one injected with venom was heard saying, ow! Fuck! Ouch! This hurts!
So it's clear that they are having a physical response to what we perceive as a painful stimuli. Is that pain? Like, are they distressed? Like, do we know what fish distress looks like? Is that fish distress?
So obviously they say that this rocking motion is similar to vertebrate-like mammals, but is that really a, like, one-on-one comparison, or are we trying to compare apples and hot dogs here? So that's my issue with Sneddon's little line there. But also, like, rubbing your snout against something could be trying to remove a stimuli that is damaging to
you.
They're probably perceiving that this is not good for them, but does that mean they're like, ouchy?
Yeah, exactly. Or is this just them trying to get rid of the thing that's causing them harm? Mm-hmm. So I found a different interview where Sneddon said that fish consumed by pain do not respond to fear-causing situations and do not show normal anti-predator behaviour. Although I couldn't find the spot in... So, like, this seemed to be carrying on from that research about rainbow trout, but I couldn't find it.
This is her extrapolation from that.
So this seems to be her extrapolating from that, which is valid, but it also could be in a different paper. I couldn't find it anywhere, so that's just worth keeping in mind when I say that.
It's interesting, yeah.
So that's sort of where we're at with pain in animals that we don't think can feel pain, so like fish, insects, stuff like that. We do a lot of this sort of research where a lot of the issues are, well, how do we know that that's a behavioural or emotional change? How do we know that the animal isn't just reacting negatively? And obviously there are a lot of people who have a lot of issues with saying that fish and insects and other invertebrates feel pain at all. James Rose of the University of Wyoming Department of Psychology, Department of Zoology and Physiology suggests that in fish there's not a snowball's chance because they don't have the hardware to have consciousness. If the apparatus isn't there, which it's not in fish, the sensation isn't either. That was a really interesting quote and a really emotional quote about this topic.
Yeah.
We're going to get on to another one in a second, which is fantastic to me.
Oh, boy.
So where I'd like to add here is that even though this is regularly framed as a debate in the media, when talking about fish specifically, a lot of scientists agree that animals like fish can feel some form of pain, even if it's not the same as our pain. And this is actually starting to have an impact on legislation, which is really, really cool. With news breaking on the 8th of October that the the Aquaculture Stewardship Council, the ASC, which is an overseas global certification scheme for farm fish, is consulting on a new draft where welfare standards, including more humane slaughter practices, are being potentially put in place after they acknowledged that fish can feel pain, stress, and anxiety.
What changed their mind?
I think it was just growing research like what Sneddon is doing, which suggests that even if it's not exactly the same as ours, they are having some form of negative response to it.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? It's not whether it's... Yeah. It doesn't have to be what we experience, but it is still a, like, physically, you know, damaging response.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So there's also this idea for me that a lot of the research that states fish cannot feel pain or insects cannot feel pain potentially should actually conclude that we don't know if they can feel pain, and instead are making really, really strong statements one way or the other.
Right, right. That's a great point. It's like the concept of like rejecting a null hypothesis, right? It's not proving that fish never feel pain. It's saying we don't know that they do, which is a different answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for example, this is where we're going to get into some scientist drama again, which is my favorite thing.
Beef.
There is a paper titled Why Fish Do Not Feel Pain by Key in 2016. And this was very, very heavily criticized by our good old friend, Dr. Sneddon, who wrote a whole paper about why... This idea was incorrect.
Yeah, I gotta say, that's a bold paper.
It's
good
a
grief.
Really bold claim to make,
what
isn't
a title.
It? So this is the abstract of Sneddon's response. So Key affirms that we do not know how fish brains process pain, but denies, because fish lack a human-like cortex, that fish can feel pain. He affirms that birds, like fish, have a slightly laminated cortex and the structure of the bird brain is quite different from the human brain, yet he does not deny that birds can feel pain. We suggest that Key's interpretations are illogical, do not reflect the published empirical evidence for pain in fish, and are out of touch with current thinking on brain evolution. We agree that more scientific data are needed to understand how brains of fish and other organisms function, but the incompleteness of current knowledge certainly does not constitute evidence for inferring that fish in particular do not feel pain.
Yeah.
Which, it's I like loved that.
Yeah, it's like Tom says about like proving a null hypothesis. Like, you know, you can't prove that nothing is happening. Like,
Absolutely. Right, right. Yeah. So to be completely honest, I really like Dr. Sneddon's work. I think some of it is really, really interesting. Whilst I don't think that all of it conclusively proves that pain exists, I think that last point is really, really important, that even though we don't know, we can't just be like, no, means they're not in pain or anything like that. It's fine. We just don't know. And a lot of animals potentially are being treated poorly or inhumanely, even though we don't actually know if they can feel pain or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where I want to leave things for today. I want to leave a final sort of note on why some of this research is useful, other than just for establishing if animals feel pain and if we should treat them correctly. And that is, especially with the fruit flies paper, that understanding how fruit flies experience pain and if it's similar to us can be useful for things like drug testing. So obviously, if a fruit fly has these nociceptors, then potential drugs that can block nociceptors from working can be tested on fruit flies to see if their behaviours change or anything like that after drugs have been administered. So we're not just being like, oh, can an animal feel pain? Like, there are actual medical uses for establishing stuff like this.
Also, to be fair, I didn't think about this in the when I was criticising it before. I didn't think about it in the context of if the researchers can establish that fish feel pain, then they can set precedents for treating fish in farming and wildlife better. So there is, although, you know, a small amount of fish may have to suffer, there is genuine reason for it down the line.
There is, like, absolutely, yeah. There is so much, like, good that can come from this sort of research. Obviously, we always feel a little bit icky about animals being in pain, but it's all really, really useful stuff. So the answer to, like, pain in animals is that a lot of animals definitely do feel pain and they feel it in a very similar way to us. And for a lot of animals, we just don't know, and research will continue. But even though we don't know, doesn't mean we should assume that they don't, and that we should treat everything with as much kindness as we can. So yeah, that's my section. Yay. Thank you for listening.
I gotta say, it's so interesting for so many reasons. You know, I think to your point, like, another thing that I find really fascinating for this research is the sort of evolutionary implications of this, because it does seem to be so common across animals. It's and because, like you said, there are. Like, no susceptors, like, it's a physical thing, and especially with, like, brain development also. You know, talking about the cortex and stuff like that, it seems very deeply interesting in that. But I will also say, just from a more meta-scientific, but just, I did not realize how, like, I knew when we were going into insect consciousness, I was like, this, we're not going to get a great answer out of this.
Oh, yeah, there's no solid answer here,
But to realize that pain is also in that same realm of, like, to Ella's point, art. And consciousness is something that I wasn't expecting. And I think that's interesting that it is part of that category of, like, hard problems in biology.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I'm so glad that this topic was a trick and a treat.
Oh, yeah.
Ba, 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 ba.
Bah, bah.
Her Majesty served Great Britain and the Commonwealth loyally for over 70 years. And while, of course, we feel a profound sadness, we must remember she lived a long life and died in such a way that I think many of us would want for ourselves. She was at home, surrounded by her family. And, of course, she was listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast, and you can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we begin our hunt for vampiric knowledge, I need to know of you adventurers. What do you two know about the feared beast known as the vampire?
Did you write that in your script? That little...
I sure did.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I'm a DM for this little... Roll for initiative, real quick.
What do you want to know that we know about vampires?
I can tell you so much.
In mythology?
I can tell you about some history about, like, how we used to stake people after they had died. Ask a Mortician does a really good video on vampires.
We gotta get her on one day. That's we gotta ask.
I love Caitlin. Caitlin, if you're listening, please.
I have both her books. Love it.
Please.
both in pop culture and in old folklore, what do you guys know about the vampire?
Here's a list of vampire things.
Nice.
Fangs.
Yes, perfect.
Can't go out in the sunlight. Garlic. Mm-hmm. Crosses. Religious yep. imagery. Need to have sex with virgins. No, sorry, need to eat virgins.
The mirror thing.
Oh, yeah, not visible yeah. mirrors. Cold.
Yes.
In Twilight, when Bella types into her fake Google, she's like, oh, is it into Bing? God, yeah. She's like, the cold ones. And as if, like, vampires don't exist, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes they're sparkly in pop culture. Yay.
Yeah, we can't say who came up with that idea. It's always been around.
It's always been a thing, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, need to drink blood to survive. That's probably a pretty good need one, to say it? That one.
Yeah, no, it's funny because that is basically the common thing amongst all folklore of vampires. That is yeah. like the thing that unites them. And, you know, while the word vampire comes from the Balkans around the 1700s, but the concept of demons or monsters or undead that suck blood from people is a surprisingly universal story. According to anthropologist Cheryl Atwater, vampires are found independently in Africa, Asia, North and South America, India, Western and Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
which, if you're keeping track on the map, only leaves out Australia and Antarctica.
And is it because they don't have animals that drink blood in those continents?
Well, It actually seems that Aboriginal Australians did have a vampire called the Yarramayahu. And as for Antarctica, what do you think is frozen in those ice caps?
Of course.
Why do you think scientists are so worried about them melting? It's because that's where the vampires are.
Obviously.
Yeah.
That's my new thing, is conspiracy theories that are secretly pro-environment and pro-science.
Save the planet or the vampires will be released.
But of course, hundreds of millions of years older than any of these vampire stories are vampiric animals themselves. And while we often think about vampire bats, and we're definitely going to be talking about them because they're so interesting, there are actually a handful of different vampiric animals. And vampire bats are not only some of the newest evolutionarily, emerging only around 20 million years ago, but they're new in literature too, because there are only 3 living species of vampire bats, and they're all native to South America.
Oh, interesting.
So while Bram Stoker knew about vampire bats by the time he wrote Dracula, vampires were among us long before that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the technical term for these animals isn't vampire, though I will be saying it because it's just easier to say it and it's fun. And some papers do occasionally say it. There's actually 2 words that scientists use interchangeably for the blood feeding behavior. So the first is hematophagy, or hematophagy, you know, hemato meaning blood and phagy meaning to feed on.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is a sanguivore.
Oh.
So sanguine deriving from blood and vore, like, you know, like carnivore.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen both used like equally as much. And you may be thinking, that's annoying. And it certainly makes researching so difficult because you think you've read all the papers and then you switch the word and there's like 50 more papers and you're like, what? But what this show has taught me with things like the thermal biology episode is that whenever you see that scientists haven't settled on a single word for something, that means you're on to what science communicators like us call the good shit. So let's dig in. Do you guys know what other vampiric animals there are?
Mosquitoes?
Yeah.
Leeches?
Yep. I'm
trying to think of like any other blood-sucking insects. There must be so many.
I will say insects are the biggest one.
Yeah, yeah.
According to a paper by Mans, Lowe, and Neitz, hematophagy evolved independently at least 6 times in the approximately 15,000 species and 400 genera of hematophagous arthropods during the Jurassic and Cretaceous
wow.
eras. So these are insects like mosquitoes, of course,
uh-huh.
And also ticks, bedbugs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a ton. And because of their tiny size, vampirism is like perfect for these fuckers. They're tiny, which means they're sneaky. And it also means that they don't have to take a ton of blood. So it like really works for their sort of like body structure. But they, of course, not the only ones. Although I will give a shout out to an insect I didn't know was vampiric. The Calyptra moth is sometimes known as the vampire moth.
Ooh.
And they do drink blood. They don't usually, but they have been noted once or twice to also drink human blood. But they basically have adapted from puncturing and drinking fruit to puncturing and drinking mammal blood, which is fascinating. I didn't know that.
That's so cool.
But there are surprisingly vampires all across the animal kingdom. Vampiric bugs, like we mentioned. Like Caroline mentioned, leeches, which are vampiric worms.
Ew.
There are vampiric fish, which are lampreys.
Oh, yeah.
Do piranhas count as vampires or just they just eat people?
Right. I would, as we're going to see, there's some very interesting things for blood drinking specifically. That I would separate it from like bloody carnivorous animals like piranhas. Yeah. But lampreys are vampiric fish. If you've never seen them, absolute nightmare fuel, just like this circular row of teeth that like sucks onto animals. So scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know this, but there are vampiric birds.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
So there's a bird known as the vampire finch that they basically peck at the wings and feet of bigger birds and, like, drink their blood.
Oh.
I will say, I do have to stipulate, it's not their primary diet. Like, they don't just do that. It's usually a thing that they'll do, like, in a dire situation. And it's interesting. It's believed that they evolved this by, like, pecking bugs off of other birds and then, you know, just, like, going a bit further and pecking the bird.
Interesting.
So, like, literally biting the hand that feeds you and being like, this is pretty good.
It's pretty tasty.
And then the last one is the vampire squid or Vampirotheathus infernalis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you know how they feed?
No idea.
No, I don't.
They drift along silently and feed on something known as sinkers. Do you know what those are?
No.
It's very spooky. So sinkers are fecal pellets.
Oh yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah, so vampire squids, they're not vampires.
No.
They don't drink blood. They're just spooky.
And they're very uncool as well. They've got this they're very uncool. They've got this very cool name and they eat poo.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I will say they are frightening and red, but
yeah.
So they were given that name because of their look, not their.
Yep. And not only them, but the entire genus Vampirotheathus for squids is just, it's just because it looks like that, which is fine. We do that for other names, but it is a little confusing. And also, not the first time this has happened where we named something a vampire that isn't a vampire, because there is a whole category of false vampire bats, including a species called Vampirum spectrum that, again, does not drink blood. Just looks spooky.
I like this. Yes, name spooky things, spooky names.
Spooky things, yeah. I was looking into them briefly, and I did find there's an interesting fact that they're one of the few species of bats that are monogamous.
Oh!
But I guess the genus name Monogamum just doesn't have the same ring as Vampirum. But, of course, there are the real vampire bats, and I want to talk about them now because they are so interesting. I came across so many bonkers papers. Right, not only are bats the only flying mammals, vampire bats are the only vampiric mammals. And on top of that, unlike the finches, they are obligate sanguivores, meaning they only consume blood. That is the only thing in their diet, which is fascinating, and we're gonna get into that. But not only that, they are the most like vampires of lore in a number of ways. Can you all guess in what ways vampire bats are like vampires?
They only come out at night.
That is true, yes.
Very, very beautiful and strong. And
Ella? Ella? You're correct.
What?
No.
They're beautiful and strong?
I have a quote. I have a quote here.
No!
This is a quote from the New York Times. It goes, "As it turns out, the three species of bat that subsist entirely on blood are much cuter than the average insect or fruit-eating bat."
No,
I don't believe it.
I disagree. No.
There is a reason why they look different.
Okay.
That is a scientific reason.
Okay.
Now,
beauty
is subjective, but...
But have you seen fruit bats?
They're so cute.
They're like puppies.
Yeah.
I do agree. And, you know, but there is actually a scientific reason why they look different and why this reporter thinks that they look cuter. Yes, of course. What about vampirism makes vampire bats more beautiful?
So what I was going to say is cuteness. This is like a scientific thing. Like, things that we find cute are, they have like they have like bigger eyes and typically bigger ears and like, but smaller faces. This is like how, this is why humans like find babies. Like, it's like an evolutionary trait. So we protect cute things. Big eyes, big ears, small, cute bodies, whatever. So maybe they've got really big eyes for seeing blood. Have they got really big ears for their sonary things? I don't know. That's my guess.
Is it something to do with their noses? Close. Because they can smell the blood? Oh, yeah, and also
little upturned noses for blood smelling.
If you combine both of your answers, you hit the money on the head. And this is so interesting. So, insect-eating bats will have to fly around at night and catch as much as like 500 bugs a night. But the way vampire bats hunt, they prey on things that are bigger, usually sleeping cows or pigs or birds. So when a vampire bat approaches its target, it will usually walk or climb up to it. As one paper put it, quote, stealth and dexterity are critical, very much like real vampires. And so what is the difference between these two strategies?
One requires bigger hands to grip you with, I don't know. Yeah.
It's related to the echolocation that Ella mentioned, which is that vampire bats don't have to rely on it as much because they're not like chasing flying targets all over the night.
Okay.
And so, to your point, Caroline, echolocating bats usually have what's known as a nose leaf, which is that like funny shaped nose that it sometimes looks like a horn, sometimes look like a leaf, and that helps them echolocate. And while vampire bats are classified as nose-leafed bats because they don't echolocate as much, according to a published field identification guide I found, vampire bats have either, quote, no distinct nose leaf or don't have a true nose leaf at all. So they have a more square, sort of like pug-like nose as opposed to this horned thing that sometimes people are put off by. So, you know, that could either be because they don't have to echolocate, or it could be the curse of vampirism, you can say for sure. But yeah, I'm so glad you guessed that, Ella. I truly could not believe that when I came across that. But I agree that we have to have a recount on what is the cutest bat. I'm happy to support that.
I honestly don't think vampire bats are that cute. I'm just looking at a picture.
Are you looking at a picture?
Oh, their ears are really cute, but then I hate their little noses. I'm just going to look at a fruit bat to just make myself feel better. Oh my goodness, so cute.
Oh my god. The New York Times is wrong about you.
It really is.
So the second way that vampire bats are like real vampires is that, much like the vampires in What We Do in the Shadows and Twilight, each species of vampire bat has a unique talent or ability when hunting. I said there are three species of vampire bats today, but they're actually in three completely different genuses. And so they vary a ton from things like the number of teeth that they have to like brain size, as well as hunting abilities. So the common vampire bat, as it is known, is one of the very few bats that is adapted to running and jumping on all fours on the ground. They run at 0.6 meters per second, which doesn't sound that fast, but to scale, that would be like a human running a 4-minute mile on all fours, which is a terrifying image.
Have you seen that guy on TikTok who trained himself how to run on all fours?
Hey, maybe you should be watching some vampire bat footage and learn some strats. And so if you were riding on the back of a common vampire bat, you would definitely have to hang on tight, Spider Monkey.
oh my god, no.
The hairy-legged bat, on the other hand, preys exclusively on birds as they sleep in trees. And so to do that, they have to be very good at climbing trees, so much so that their calcar, which is this like piece of cartilage on their ankle, has evolved to grow long enough that it has been described as, quote, co-opted for a new role as an opposable digit. Some people have called it like a sixth finger on their foot.
Okay.
That works sort of like an opposable thumb so that they can like grip trees better, which I think Jasper had in the movies. I could be wrong. I think he had a sixth toe. I could be wrong. But the last one is that, as the New York Times described it, the white-winged vampire bat approaches a potential host chicken so softly and lovingly that the bird is deceived and sweeps it up to its brood patch as though to warm its own chick.
That's amazing.
That's
obviously
so cool.
Vampire hypnotism.
That's
clear
very
case
cool.
of vampire thrall.
That's actually really cool. I've never heard of that. I love that.
They're so sneaky. It's so interesting. Yeah.
Whoa.
Can I just say you just compared those powers to those abilities, the powers in Twilight. And imagine, apart from the last one, imagine you were like a new vampire coming to the Cullen Clan and being, and they you say, oh, I have an ability too, and then you know you hear about the mind reading and the emotional control, and they go, wow, oh, what's yours then? You're like, I have a sixth toe that grabs onto things. Wow.
And the guy's like, man, I really should not have gone last. This sucks. Oh my god. Okay, the third similarity is that vampire bats, like I said earlier, are not just blood drinkers, they are obligate blood drinkers, meaning they only drink blood and they physically can't eat anything else, with the exception of breast milk when they're young. But otherwise, you know, much like the vampires in What We Do in the Shadows, they physically can't eat food, which I thought was really interesting. Instead, they have to drink blood every night, and they can consume up to their full body weight in blood.
Wow. I'm really interested in, you probably won't get into this, but I'm really interested in just the idea of like subsisting on blood, like how
Ella,
a mammal.
We're gonna get exactly into that.
Yeah, yeah. Because
that's like,
the
most
nutritional
part.
Value of blood. Like,
oh, Ella,
so
get ready. You are on the money. We will get into that in a second. The fourth similarity I want to talk about is actually a question, which is, how do vampire bats know where to bite?
They have to have some kind of like super sense for like artery or veins, like where things are closer to the surface or like the blood is. Mm-hmm. I guess you would want probably maybe like arterial blood or something like is better.
Yeah.
I don't know. So
yeah, but which sense would they use for that?
I'm gonna guess touch. And feel like
interesting
pulsating, but now I feel wrong.
Some heat, like heat reception.
Ooh, yeah.
There you go. So, of course, it's likely a lot of factors, but vampire bats do have a specific heat sensing organ. So in vampire movies, it's sometimes portrayed as this like blood vision, like they can like see
the
veins.
Yeah, that's exactly
in
what I was thinking. Where you can see like it like zooms in, you can see like that, you can hear like the pulsating of the heart.
Yeah,
and you can
see
that, and the vision goes red. You know.
Vampire bats have something known as a pit organ on their nose that lets them sense heat at a distance.
Oh, no way.
Only other animals that we know of that have this are certain snakes, which is wild. And this lets them not only find their prey, but find the juiciest spot on their prey.
Oh, wow.
To your point, Caroline, I'm sure they use some other factors like touch, but that is one of the things that is unique to them. The final similarity between vampires and vampire bats is wild. I don't know how I haven't come across this fact before. So, like vampires from folklore, vampire bats are extremely sensitive to having a stake driven through their heart. It's fatal.
Wow. No, oh my god, Tom, that's whoa. Who could have seen that coming? We've done a year of this.
Okay, but there are, of course, many differences between vampires and vampire bats, and, you know, these
I'm
aren't
so
just
glad
me.
You said that, Tom.
Listen, I'm not going to just go through and be like, actually, vampires don't do that, but I do want to talk about two in particular that are super interesting. The first is a difference in how they actually consume blood. So how do vampires in stories consume their blood when they bite?
They drink it. They just drink it. Surely
they puncture and suck.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wait, so okay, can I take a stab at this one?
Of course.
One? So is it like do they add blood thinners so that it like drips out, because I know that a lot of insects do that. That was my stab at it. There you go. Yeah.
And also things like insects also will add to the site, like mosquitoes, something so you don't know it's happening, right? Like
anesthetic,
exactly.
Yeah. So vampires and media are seen as having these sharp canine teeth, right, that suck the blood out. It varies, obviously. Some, I feel like, describe it like, right, and, you know, they have those two signature bite marks.
Yeah.
Those have been around since Dracula was written. That's like a big part of Dracula, is those like two bite marks.
Yeah.
And I feel like some describe it, the idea is, do you guys know how like some snakes have like hollow fangs that like inject poison?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Is it like that in reverse, where like the teeth suck the blood?
No.
It's
my understanding that they drink the blood after they.
Yeah, like okay, they gulp okay. it down rather than like sucking it. I feel like
the concept of like the teeth sucking blood up is so disgusting to me. Like, that's horrible.
Just like two straws. I feel like I've seen that.
No,
somewhere.
I don't believe you.
All right.
I could be wrong, but it's weird.
But vampire bats do have those signature long canine teeth, but they don't use them to draw blood.
What?
And they actually, in fact, have some of the weakest bites of any bat.
Nice.
Instead, no way.
They actually use their incisors, which are their like sharp buck teeth.
Oh.
And they just gnaw a little divot into their prey.
Oh, so they just gnaw like one little hole into them, basically. Yeah.
And I admit, it would not be as sexy if Edward had just like two razor sharp buck teeth the whole time. And it's like, and so the lion fell in love with Len.
It's a good joke, Tom, but the vampires in Twilight don't have canine fangs. So,
oh, do they not?
No.
No, they don't. They leave like a full bite mark.
Yeah, they like have like a super strong just mouth bite. Yeah.
God, Tom, you watched the film. You should
I guess that's
know
more
this.
Accurate.
So
instead of leaving like a snake bite, it leaves a quote distinctive crater-like wound on the host.
So actually, without even realizing, you've just given us another similarity to Twilight vampires.
Just Twilight though.
Other vampires are the most accurate.
Oh
vampire?
Yeah, that's what we get.
Oh
that's
no,
it's.
Oh, dear.
We'll count at the end. We'll see. And then, to your point, Caroline, they lick up the blood with their tongue, and their saliva has anticoagulants to stop the wound from patching up so that it keeps bleeding. But the most interesting difference between vampire bats and vampires in stories is something that Ella brought up, that is something that, once you start thinking about it, seems very... There's a lot to it. And it's not actually in the behavior of the bats that's different, but in their physiology. So when the mythology of like blood-sucking monsters was being created, we didn't know much about blood, right? We were talking about animal spirits, right? And famously, it was considered one of the four essential humors in ancient Greek and Roman medicine. And so drinking blood was seen as like drinking power or life force from someone. But to your point, Ella, we know now it's not your life force, it's just blood. Mm. And blood is, according to the New York Times, a, quote, surprisingly thin gruel.
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
yeah,
there's protein in blood, a little bit, but not like a lot, and certainly not enough to like for a human to run on. There's
totally.
I just cannot imagine what they're getting out of it.
Like a handful of minerals and that's
exactly
it, really. Yeah.
So, as 29 authors put it in a paper in Nature, quote, blood is a challenging dietary source because it consists of 78% liquid phase and the dry matter phase consisting of 93% proteins and only 1% carbohydrates, providing very low levels of vitamins and potentially containing blood-borne pathogens.
Yeah.
I had never thought about this before, but your intuition was totally right, Ella. Like, it's not just a hunting behavior. It's as much, as one paper put it, a radical dietary lifestyle. I said earlier that vampire bats hunt every single night. And that's not because they like to. It's because they have to. Because blood doesn't give them any long-term energy like fats or carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And so, if they miss two or three meals, they will literally starve to death. Which is
Whoa.
Totally unheard of for a mammal.
Yeah, that's bonkers.
Oh my God.
This all makes a lot more sense now in this context. You drink totally. Their whole body weight. They do it every night. It's like, yeah. They mm-hmm. have to.
They have to. Yeah, exactly. And most of the articles that talk about this behavior describe vampire bats as like existing in spite of drinking blood because it's just like not a good meal. Blood is as a food is basically water, iron, salt, and disease. That's like all it is.
This is like, you know, this the idea of just evolution, like the most advantageous traits like being passed down, just like. And then it throws something like this in.
Yeah, like how did we get here?
It's just a doll.
It's really. Well, I mean, again, there's three species of vampire bats
who are not in the same. You said they're not in the same gene.
They're in three different. I think they're in the same family. They're in three different genuses, and there are a lot of species of extinct vampire bats that also belong to those genuses. But there's only three.
Oh, that's a good point. There's a lot of. Extinct ones that these are
but also, you know, to your point to the point earlier about like the birds, like it's thought that these evolved from like eating meat to eating, and you know, both like fruits and insects are very like liquidy sometimes, and so you can see how this happens, but a lot has to happen.
Yeah,
because they do exist in spite of all of that. They exist, and to do that they have evolved, quote, extensive morphological and physiological modifications of their stomach, which is unparalleled by any other mammalian species.
Oh wow.
The quote goes on: most notably, the stomach of the common vampire bat experienced a fundamental remodeling from a compact muscular organ involved in mechanical and chemical digestion towards a distensible structure that functions primarily to store large amounts of ingested blood and serves as a major site of fluid absorption. So to survive on blood, they had to change their stomachs from being something that breaks down food with acid to something that can store and absorb liquid, which is wild. On top of that, their gut microbiomes and their metabolisms and their endocrine system are highly tuned to offset the low amount of vitamins and nutrients that they get. Ella, I don't know if your insulin research involved any vampires, but if it did, you would know that they have extremely low insulin levels.
Of course, because there's basically no sugar in blood
at all. Yeah,
but what if here's a fun question.
Yeah,
for thought experiment, vampire bat bites an untreated diabetic person. Do you think that'll kill them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh man.
Think they'll go into like,
I don't think they'd be able to process
like hyperglycemia or something. They would just be so
Writers
overloaded with sugar.
Take note. Stephanie Myers. Great plot point. And these sort of microbiome changes are so extreme that in a study from 2018, they found that vampire bat microbiomes have, quote, potentially protective bacteria, which have been shown to produce antiviral compounds against bacteriophages and pox viruses.
That makes sense. You know, there's just no way that kind of species could survive with that many bloodborne diseases. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, without having this sort of like fundamentally different
inner
bacterial system, which
definitely.
Is wild.
Surely they must be like a really interesting resource for looking at how fight off certain diseases then.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. But the main takeaway is, horror writers, I want to see vampires that live on orange farms and that take gummy supplements, because that is an important part of their life. But there is one last really cool adaptation to this radical dietary lifestyle, and it actually doesn't have to do with their guts or their microbiomes. I said earlier that vampire bats need to feed basically every night, but I left something out in that description. As a paper from the journal Adaptive Behavior put it, quote, vampire bats are unusually sensitive to food deprivation, having no mechanism to retain energy within body tissues and rely on a single blood meal sought once per night. This meal is by no means certain, and two missed meals without any form of assistance are fatal. And it's that last bit that I left out, without any form of assistance. So what could assistance mean?
Feeding each other?
Oh, they
by,
can
like
they can
bringing
do
extra. So they like they store up loads and then they like blood like vomit out like birds do at each other.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness.
That's incredible.
It's something known as trophallaxis, or regurgitating food for each other, which like you said exactly is what birds do. This is a quote from that same paper. Common vampire bats appear to form self-help food-sharing groups of approximately 20 animals. Adults and infants who regularly associate and roost together from larger colonies of several hundred bats. Specifically, the common vampire bat has been observed regurgitating blood meals not only to their young, but also between adults.
Yeah, that's no interesting. It makes sense to do this to your offspring.
Yeah,
but to do
absolutely.
It to other adults, I guess there must be some benefit to having more, like, greater numbers of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just purely because of the fact that it's just so difficult. And we're going to get into something interesting, which is that it seems like it is a relatively complex social thing because not only do they share, a study in 1984 found that they're much more likely to share with each other with bats that they know have shared before.
Oh, that's
interesting.
Bat socialism.
Well, I mean, it means that they know that like, oh, fucking Jim's an asshole. I'm not going to give him blood. Like, fucking rotten hell, Jim. But on top of that, there's a study from 2020 by Carter et al. That found that vampire bats will literally test these relationships. Basically, when new bats are introduced to each other, they will start grooming each other first to see if the bat will reciprocate and, like, if they're friendly. And only after they've, like, established trust for a long period of time will they finally share blood.
There's a risk of anthropomorphizing here and being like, look at these little community things where they really like each other. And like, maybe there is an element of that, but realistically, it's just a resource thing, right? You can't be providing blood to animals, like your limited resources to animals who won't give you that thing back.
But to push against that, I will say it does show a certain level of social complexity to be able to recognize a bat and remember that they are a selfish asshole, right? Even if, to your point, it is more of a rudimentary reason that you are like friends with this bat, it does underlie a social understanding in a sense, mm-hmm. right? That is complex. Like, you have to remember who is kind and recognize them, which is wild, truly wild. And the fact that there's these gradations of it where it's not like, I fully trust you. It's like, well, you groom me a few times. Let's see
each
other.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And to your point, I think the biggest indicator is the fact that these are like non-familial bonds. That's really interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
So to put it all together, real vampires in nature are beautiful. They're sneaky. They run fast. They can only eat blood. But most importantly, they care about their families and friends. And which fictional vampires would be most likely to regurgitate blood for their found family than the Cullens? In conclusion, Your Honor, I believe I've compiled a foolproof case to show that the series that portrays vampires in the most scientifically accurate way is Twilight.
Yes, plus the other point, which is the Twilight vampires don't have fangs. So another point on top of that, you're completely right, Tom.
Yeah,
I completely
nailed this.
I agree with your conclusion 100%.
Uh-huh. As people of the scientific background, you've done your research here completely.
And no other biases.
No,
sure
we should write a paper about this.
Oh, my
goodness.
Well, I will say, I mean, if Stephanie Myers is listening, all you need to do is give Edward buck teeth and some multivitamins, and then it's a 10 out of 10. But yeah, that's vampires.
Oh, I love that.
That was so interesting. There are two points that stick out to me a lot here, which is the nutritional thing. Wild.
Yeah,
wildly interesting.
Wild.
And those little cuckold bats.
Little sneaky guys.
Amazing. Some real like nuggets of gold there over in a very good topic. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Bat researchers, thank you truly for all of your gifts. There's so many
what
bonkers
a group
studies.
Of people.
Amazing.
Yeah, bats are incredible.
You're in a theater. The lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
The solemn tones of an old cathedral clock have announced midnight. The air is thick and heavy. A strange, death-like stillness pervades all nature. Like the ominous calm which precedes some more than usually terrific outbreak of the elements, they seem to have paused, even in their ordinary fluctuations, to gather a terrific strength for the great effort. A faint peal of thunder now comes from far off, like a signal gun for the battle of the winds to begin. It appeared to awaken them from their lethargy, and one awful, warning hurricane swept over a whole city, producing more devastation in the 4 or 5 minutes it lasted than would a half century of ordinary phenomena. This is the opening paragraph to Vani the Vampire, or The Feast of Blood, by Thomas Peckett Prest and James Malcolm Reiner, which was released in installments between 1845 and 1847. And it is one of the most famous examples of today's miscellaneous topic. The early 1800s and subsequent Victorian era of 1837 to 1901 was the era of Gothic horror. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White, Bram Stoker's Dracula, atmospheric, tense and dark with poignant themes of morality and philosophy. But that's not what we're talking about today. Because today's topic is the Penny Dreadful. Do either of you know what Penny Dreadfuls are?
I feel so bamboozled right now.
Bamboozled.
Oh my goodness.
I feel like I should know.
So it's
this.
Not those things.
It's not Frankenstein, it's not Dracula, but it is that thing that I opened with.
Is it like, I'm just breaking it down, Penny Dreadful, is it like a cheap, like, horror story?
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. That is exactly it.
Wow!
Penny Dreadfuls are sensationalized and shocking serialized stories typically published in 8-page installments.
Also, great drag name, Penny Dreadful.
Oh my god! Bagsy, yeah. Bagsy, it's mine. That's my drag name. That's such a good one. So basically, as the rate of literacy, it was skyrocketing in Britain from below 30% in the mid-1700s to over 80% in 1900. Wow. The desire to read fiction rose quite alarmingly too.
Yeah.
But a lot of literature like that I described was very inaccessible to the working class. It was difficult to read. It was expensive to buy. And they couldn't just, like, type Frankenstein free PDF into Google like you can now. So you have this, like, market of literate people probably sitting around in their homes reading nothing but the Bible by candlelight. And as I said before, this was the era of Gothic horror. So we have this perfect setting for these short, melodramatic stories that come out of Penny Dreadfuls. So they were first published in the 1830s. First called Penny Bloods, also Penny Awfuls, Penny Horribles. But finally, the name Penny Dreadful stuck. The important part, as Tom said, being penny, as they cost just a penny to buy, more affordable because they were printed on cheap wood pulp paper.
Wow!
That quality, or lack thereof, that made them affordable also means many of them have been completely lost to time.
Of course, yeah.
Of course, yeah. What a contextual era this is. Because at first I was just like, Penny Dreadfuls were just like, yeah, you know, it was some like really shitty, spooky horror stories for a little bit. But in the context of books becoming popular needing something that is cheap and for the masses.
Yeah.
When
there
are like not many stories. Mm-hmm. Not many books to read, not much literature.
Well, also not many books that are accessible to
isn't it? Yeah. It's really about accessibility. That literature is booming at this time. There's lots to read. There just isn't an easy way for a lot of people to do it.
Yeah.
And I think I would not have guessed, but it in some ways makes perfect sense that the genre of horror would arise and like take this opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's so That's so interesting.
Like I said, a lot of these stories have been lost to time, but we'll never recover them. But we do have many full stories left of the more famous examples, like this one I started with, which is Varney the Vampire. This story came before Dracula and basically established many tropes we now associate with vampires. This is the first mention in literature of vampires having fangs and leaving puncture wounds.
No fucking way! Can I tell you, Ella, So I've been reading Dracula through the like daily Dracula thing. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Yeah,
they like email you Dracula chronologically as it happens. And it's so funny reading that because it's like you're seeing all these vampire tropes and it's so tropey to us now. But
before they were... they're tropey to us now, but they weren't tropes then. They were original. But you know what? Some of them weren't.
Wow.
Varney the Vampire also had hypnosis, super strength, vampires as aristocracy, creeping through girls' windows at night, these kind of like things that we think are very tropey as vampires now.
A classic Edward thing.
There are also several stories sensationalizing the adventures of the famous highwayman Dick Turpin, which are very popular. And I would say the most enduring example created in A Penny Dreadful is Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Get the fuck out of town!
Mm-hmm. What? Oh my goodness.
Was West Side Story also one of them? Or any of the other Sondheim shows?
So his debut story is called The String of Pearls, a romance. I don't know how it's a romance.
Bold claim from them there. Yeah. Yeah.
But I did read it. It's pretty fun. It goes back and forth between the perspective of Todd and characters like Johanna.
Did you read it for this?
I read it for this.
Wow.
It was because it was really interesting. So it goes back and forth between the perspectives of Todd and characters like Johanna, who is in the play but is not his daughter. She's suspicious that he killed her lover, so she dresses as a boy and starts working for him. You have his former assistant who is stuck in a madhouse because he's accused Todd of murder. And you, of course, have Mrs. Lovett, who makes pies from his victims. And here is an excerpt from the original Sweeney Todd, or The String of Pearls. Mrs. Lovett received him graciously as an acquaintance and invited him into the parlour while the two limbs of the law continued eating and praising the pies. Delicious, ain't they? Said one. Oh, I believe you, replied the other. And such jolly lots of gravy too, ain't there? I wonder how she does make 'em. Lord bless you. I almost live upon 'em, you know. I used to take all me meals with my fat old Uncle Marsh, but since he disappeared one day, I live on Lovett's pies instead.
I love it. I love how much it still hits after all this time. Like, that slaps. Mm-hmm. That rules. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you're a fan of the Sondheim musical or, like, the film adaptation or anything like that, it's not what you get in this Penny Dreadful. It's not gory. Death is, like, alluded to with a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like, in that excerpt. And also, everyone is so emotionally stilted because they're Victorians.
They wouldn't dream of breaking out into song.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. But for the time, Penny Dreadfuls like this were quite scandalous. Mm-hmm. George Augustus Sala, who was an apprentice of Charles Dickens and a huge fan of Penny Dreadfuls, wrote in 1861 that Penny Dreadfuls were a world of dormant peerages, of murderous baronets and ladies with title addicted to the study of toxicology, of gypsies and brigand chiefs, men with masks and women with daggers, of stolen children, withered hags, heartless gamesters, nefarious rogues, foreign princesses, Jesuit fathers, gravediggers, resurrection men, lunatics and ghosts.
Wow.
Tag yourself. I'm ghosts. Wow.
I'm definitely women with daggers. By the mid to late 18th century, the most popular Penny Dreadfuls were actually selling 30,000 copies a week.
Wow. What?
But this wasn't to an adult audience, though. They were the main target at first, but they started to drift away and the focus turned to children instead. And this made commercial sense because 45% of the population of Britain was under 20 in 1861.
That's such an interesting point.
Yeah, I know. I didn't even... And also, that's such a high percentage of young.
Yeah, that's
like...
huge.
Also, I feel like as literacy education starts, it starts with children.
Yes, you have
this generation movement of like...
And we're going to get onto that as well. Because this isn't just a story of cheap literature. But for the readers, it is this like cheap escapist fantasy for young people who didn't really get to behave like children a lot of the time. They had little schooling. They often worked in factories.
Yeah.
Ironically, some of the children who read Penny Dreadfuls would have likely worked in the printing presses that made them.
Just like as it's flying by, reading it really quick. Just like,
But they still would have bought and read them. Mm. And many of the stories became aimed at boys, full of like daring adventures of the Spring-Heeled Jack, Charlie Wag, and the Wild Boys of London. And as Tom kind of
got to... You could be making these up.
I know, it's crazy. It's like, you know when people, Americans do sketches where they make fun of the way British people talk?
Oh, yeah.
And this is that completely. Mm-hmm. But these stories had, as Tom kind of guessed, a surprisingly positive effect. Working class children with almost no disposable income would pool their money to buy Penny Dreadfuls, and they would read them aloud to each other. They would pass them around. There's a very clear trend that shows that they were contributing to growing literacy in the working classes.
Wow.
Oh, nothing warms my heart more than a bunch of kids reading books to each other.
And all I can think in my mind is like a dusty child with like soot on their face.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Blimey, sir. I'm going to fuck up my Penny Dreadful today. But not everyone saw this benefit.
Why am I not surprised by that?
Victorian Britain had very staunch moral values stemming largely from Christianity.
I feel like the church... Church not going to be happy about
this. Hard work, honesty,
you guys
got to
read the Bible again. Read it again.
Exactly. So hard work, honesty, sexual propriety were key tenets of this philosophy. So stories about grave diggers, women with daggers, and ghosts being read primarily by children started a wave of moral panic. Mm-hmm. In fact, the dreadful label of Penny Dreadful was adopted over the original name Penny Blood as a misleading pejorative in the discourse around the stories.
To make it seem worse?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Now, commenters of the time went wild with moral outrage. Francis Hitchman called Penny Dreadfuls the literature of rascaldom. A literature which is... I know.
Yeah, baby!
It's so great. A literature which has done much to people... our prisons, our reformatories, and our colonies with scapegoats and ne'er-do-wells.
I love... Yeah, this reminds me of... I know this is a strange connection, but the reason the band Daft Punk is called that is because they got that in a review. They were like, this is just Daft Punk. And they were like, well, we'll take it. I love this sort of it is the literature of rascaldom. Yeah, it is dreadful. Hell yeah, it's dreadful.
Yeah, I love it. In his book, Leaves from a Prison Diary, journalist Michael Davitt called Penny Dreadfuls the pestilent literature of rascaldom, which has educated so many criminal characters in this country. And rascaldom is my word of the week. I love that word.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, this type of commentary had real consequences. A 1994 research paper called Disseminating Impure Literature, the Penny Dreadful publishing business, says that around 1870, one of the largest publishers of Penny Dreadfuls was raided and closed down by the police.
No way.
Whoa!
What yeah. for?
For spreading... Yeah, for spreading these...
Being
this
immoral?
Immoral wow. tale.
Wow!
And throughout the 1870s, many people were having Penny Dreadfuls confiscated from them by the police.
No way.
I will also, you know, not to defend it, but also, again, in this context of rising literature, right? Like, this is like a relatively novel medium in a way. So it is interesting that I feel like, you know, people, I'm sure, felt at the time that they were like, we can staunch this while there's like a finite number of books that exist.
Yeah, definitely.
To continue the real world consequences, in 1892, the Grantham Journal published an article called The Effects of the Penny Dreadful, talking about the case of two teenagers who had robbed a farm. And they claimed that the boys formed part of a gang who, led by sensational literature, had built a cave in a yard and filled it with firearms, knives, and the proceeds of robberies.
This is the equivalent of people being like, video games are really yes. people's lives. Like,
yes,
it's exactly
literally.
The same thing.
And it gets worse than this. In 1895, 13-year-old Robert Combs murdered his mother. The prosecution in his case accused his interest in Penny Dreadfuls of being part of the inspiration for the murder.
No. That's absurd. Wow.
And this all led to Alfred Harmsworth, who was the founder of that most respectable tabloid, the Daily Mail.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Considering it his moral duty to put an end to the youth corrupting penny dreadfuls, he started producing half penny dreadfulers, which is a great name.
Excuse me?
Wow. One
more time.
Half penny dreadfulers in the 1890s. And these told righteous, high-minded moral tales. And they cost half a penny to buy, so people were more likely to purchase them over penny dreadfuls.
Can you imagine anything more boring in this world?
Wow.
Than the Daily Mail creator making moral stories for children.
But the thing is, like the Daily Mail, these things also eventually turned into the same stories that they condemned, because those were the things that sold.
Of course they did. Yeah.
That's so funny.
And like you were saying, Caroline, this moral panic is so reminiscent of what we have seen 100 years later around rap and heavy metal music, around video games, around Harry Potter even.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So in an article by Alta Obscura, history professor Jonathan Rose says, adolescents, naturally, you might even say it's a healthy attitude, like to read stuff their parents don't like. It's an eternal phenomenon of adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So in my last miscellaneous topic, we touched about how older generations like to look down on younger generations.
Yeah.
And you might recall a quote from 1695, which is, "I find by sad experience how the towns and streets are filled with lewd, wicked children." It very much gives rascaldom vibes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
I think penny dreadfuls became just another way to point fingers at the youth of the time for being, disruptive rascals, because it was something they didn't understand. And adults pointing fingers at children like this is a tradition held long before the 1900s and well held into today. But to finish, penny dreadfuls, they did shortly fall out of favour in the early 1900s. And production stopped, but they really paved the way for things like serialized crime stories, and that includes things like Sherlock Holmes and cheap, thrilling pulp fiction stories that became really popular in America. In 1939, George Orwell wrote, "No one in his senses would want to turn the so-called penny dreadful into a realistic novel or a socialist tract." And he wasn't exactly wrong. Penny dreadfuls are not Frankenstein or Dracula, destined for hundreds of thoughtful adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's like a bit of snobbery in this quote.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's looking down on fantastical escapist fiction made largely for the working class.
Yeah, when you were listing all of those things, I was like, this is making my brain go like wild to think like it's just so much great imagery that, you know, to George Orwell's point, you know, maybe might not have the deep morals, but has so much valuable creativity that is amazing.
Yes, I completely agree. And to that, in 1935, British bookseller C.A. Stonehill said that it is highly probable that in its day, more people read Thomas Press' first False Step or The Maniac Father than had ever heard of a book published in the same decade entitled Jane Eyre.
Wow.
That is so interesting to think of like what the classics get to be, right?
Yeah, and they're often not things that were popular at the time, which I think is so interesting.
That is so interesting.
And so although the legacy of penny dreadfuls doesn't necessarily live on in the stories, I think it lives on in different ways. Obviously through Sweeney Todd being adapted, but also I feel the last 50 years of sensational gory horror flicks that are made really for teenagers to get a thrill out of, that feels like a spiritual successor to penny dreadfuls.
Definitely, yeah. Totally.
And people look down on this type of media today as well. Yeah. They make distinction between films like Midsommar as highbrow elevated horror versus something like The Conjuring as lowbrow jump scare horror. But I love it all. I think that there's huge value, like Tom said, in this creative and fun and accessible media, which penny dreadfuls were more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The production aspect of it is so interesting because it makes me think of the rise of like super indie horror, like Blair Witch Project, right? Which is like the most like a penny dreadful because it's so cheap. It costs a penny to make, right?
Yeah.
Basically.
It's about the baseline of entry being lower to it. That means that maybe the quality isn't as good, but also it means that anyone can make it or read it.
Yeah. The idea, like, I feel like parents these days would kill for kids to be secretly reading right? books to each other and like yeah. saving up for books, which you know, which isn't. It's very easy to be like, oh, that's because books are good. But the lesson from that is it's not that books are inherently good. It's that we have to reconsider what are going to be the books of the future, right? That yeah. we're going to look back on and be like, I can't believe you didn't, like, you thought that video games were going to corrupt people when mm-hmm. when we have all these lessons that, like, there is so much to gain from all of these yeah. wonderful art form. Like, just imagine all the authors that come out of Pinterest. Yeah.
You made mm-hmm. to me such a good point then. This idea that we look back and we're like, how do we think that Penny Dreadfuls could corrupt people?
Yeah.
And now it's like
literally
just the same cycle over and over again. It's uh-huh. it's almost as if people don't learn from history.
What a wild concept.
That's actually the end of my topic, guys. I guess
amazing.
And at the end, I guess I just want to ask you: are you guys horror fans? You like? I'm a huge horror fan. Do you ever read? What, do you have any favorites?
So I'm not like a huge horror person, but it's always something that I enjoy, like going and having like the experience of doing it. Like I went to see Nope in the cinema. That's really like the most recent horror-esque film that I've seen, and it's always just such fun. It's like
horror is fun.
That I don't know, it makes my brain work in a way that it's not used to working of like yeah. watching these films yeah. And that's just like a generally very enjoyable experience for me. What about you, Tom?
I was gonna say that I relatively recently had a friend finally convince me to get into horror. The first one we watched was The Blair Witch Project in college.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, I was spooked. But now I've really come to love it. And to your point, Caroline, it really is, especially with horror films, it's such a different world that has its like language.
Yeah.
Like movies like I watched Drag Me to Hell and I was like, I don't know what the fuck to expect next. Like uh-huh. I don't know what's happening.
Drag Me to Hell is so good.
And then like Cabin in the Woods is like a treatise on like horror movies, and it's just like there's so much to this.
That's the thing about horror as a genre. There's one of the reasons I love yeah. horror, that it can be so many different things within
yeah,
that.
Yeah, definitely.
The common thread between them is like fear, but the story that underlies that can be anything at all, which yeah. I find really interesting, and it's such a like an interesting medium to express those things through. But on the other side, if it's not expressing anything, it's not got loads of metaphors, and it's a gory jump scare extravaganza, I fucking love that too.
Yeah.
I love horror. And to your point, Tom, you've just gotten into horror movies, right? If you ever read at all, then I do recommend horror, like books, literature. I don't find horror movies scary anymore because I'm so oversaturated. I've been watching them since I was about six.
Oh wow!
Oh,
I watched The Ring when I was six. So it really desensitized me. I'm really desensitized to horror. I still really enjoy it, but horror yeah. literature is so tense and spine chilling to me. And because your imagination can create whatever you find scariest.
Can I tell you, so I've been reading Daily Dracula, and what's so interesting is when they talk about Dracula's powers, they're so ambiguous. Like they talk about just like oceans of like wolves howling and stuff like that. It's and like in my mind, I'm picturing like fantastical things that like even the movies of Dracula don't depict because they're so metaphorical. That's a totally yeah. great point, Ella. I will also say, I feel like horror anime, if you
yes.
if desensitized to horror movies than animation, boy howdy.
And that's another yeah howdy. I think that fits in the same vein as literature in that it can do a lot more than
yeah
more
yeah,
horror.
Yeah.
Ella, do you have any horror literature to recommend? And Tom, do you have any horror anime to recommend?
Oh yeah, okay, so I'm not gonna go super obvious with it. Ugh, maybe a bit. Like if you're really new to horror literature, like reading something like Misery, Carrie by Stephen King is obviously a great place to start. But yeah, I really like Let the Right One In by John Lindquist, which is about vampires, but in a really strange... It's a vampire who is a 12-year-old girl, and it's really dark. It's very good.
Ooh.
It's very tense. And also anything by Ray Bradbury, who wrote Fahrenheit 451, which is a dystopian novel, but he was a really good short story horror writer as
well. Oh, nice. Okay, cool.
I would say the best introductory horror stuff, I think, would be Jordan Peele's works, because if you're ever too scared, you can be like, I'm going to focus on the social implications of this.
Yeah.
they're not the most scary, but I love Hereditary. I have a hard time recommending it because it's so...
I've not watched it yet, and it's
one of my favorites.
Oh, man.
For anime, Neon Genesis Evangelion is so frightening at times. Anything by Satoshi Kon is deeply chilling.
I have the best horror recommendation. Everyone should Junji Ito, any work by Junji Ito.
You're totally right. Yeah.
A horror manga writer, but really he's an artist. And the
Amigara Faults, everyone will have seen
Amigara Faults, which is genuinely one of the most terrifying short stories I've ever read. Yeah. But then you have one, it's about a town that's like obsessed with spirals, and it's called Uzumaki. They're making it into a TV show, and I'm fascinated to see how they're going to do it. But Junji Ito, really, really
perfect. Perfect, Rick, yeah.
Nice.
I love horror. All right, Caroline, do your thing.
Well, I was going to ask if there were any plugs or shout. Oh, no, wait, I lie. It's Review Corner.
Caroline!
You literally asked them to... Ella! You literally said, Caroline, do your thing.
That's my job!
I can't fucking believe... Jesus.
I get told off every time for bringing up Review Corner.
Yes, I asked you to do it, but you should have known. That was a test and you failed.
Ella, what time is it?
I don't know.
It's Review Corner.
Today's review comes from Amanda Dog Emoji on Apple Podcasts, and they say, inspirational, enlightening, and all around joyful. Ella, Tom, and Caroline are fantastic science communicators with contagious laughter and an immensely apparent passion for learning. I've been obsessed with this podcast from episode one, and I would recommend it to anyone. I love to rack my brain for the answers along with the hosts. And like a good game of Jeopardy, I get giddy when I have the answer before them. Because I am more often than not deeply humbled and impressed by the knowledge these three possessed. It's beyond inspirational to see people just older than myself succeeding so skillfully in the field I'm just stepping into. And I'm waiting with bated breath for every new episode. And they have merch now. I can't wait for my shirt.
Does it actually say that, or did you add that
in? It really does. It really does.
No. Oh my god.
That's so quick.
Thank you so much, Amanda, with the dog emoji. That's so nice.
It's spooky how emotional I got reading that.
Oh, these tears on my face are so spooky. Must be ghost ectoplasm. Wow. Thank you so much. And when you get your shirt, you should post a picture of it in our Discord server, which anyone can join by going to letslearneverythingpod.com.
And we've just added a bunch of new stuff to our shop, including a shirt that has every single topic that we've covered in the past year, a mug, a poster, some stickers. It's all at letslearneverythingpod.com/store.
Woo! Amazing. Okay, do we have any more plugs or shout-outs?
I'll just plug everyone a quick little plug.
Nice.
I am Tom Lumperson at all places. Caroline is Caroline the Bug on all places. And Ella is Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok and at Ella Hubber on Twitter.
So, this episode, we learned that animals might be able to feel pain. We'll probably never know. We learned that the vampires from Twilight are possibly the most accurate to actual vampires in the real world. And that's just silly. And we learnt once again that generations never seem to learn from the ones before them.
And also, spooky stuff rules! And always has.
Yeah!
Join us next time, where we will learn about
everything! Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum. Is this an updated version, Tom?
Slightly updated, yeah.
It sounds spookier.
Oh!
too spooky for you.
Is it too spooky? Should I tone it down?
Yeah.
Are we worried we're going to scare anyone?
I'm frightened.
That was really
good. That was amazing. What? What? That was so accurate.
I didn't know I could do that.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.